Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we explore a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic, and a very happy birthday to you, my friend. Did you have a nice birthday?
I sure did. I appreciate you saying so. It was a great birthday. We, just spent it with the family. Which my favorite restaurant for lunch yesterday. Got an iPhone today. Got upgraded from the last model to a more current model, and so yeah, it's been a good birthday all around. It's been fun.
Well, very nice, excellent, and this is just a week of celebrations because obviously tonight is our big fifth anniversary special here on Fast Forward Radio. We're celebrating 5 years of the program on Blog Talk Radio. As we're always careful to point out, that's not 5 years of us doing the show because we were doing it for a couple of years before we started doing it on Blog Talk Radio, but we've been doing it weekly for the past 5 years, and so hard to believe it's been 5 years, isn't it?
That's right. So yeah, as I said before the show started, Phil, if it just wasn't an absolute blast, we both would have probably moved on by now, right? I mean, this is the sort of thing. It's just absolutely a labor of love. We have a great time doing it, both this and blogging back at The Speculist. It's just fun, and so we keep doing it because we're just having a great time doing it.
I was saying before the show started, we've actually been blogging together for 8 years, and that part just kind of blows me away. We're coming up on the 10th anniversary of The Speculist. I can hardly believe that in August of next year. So we'll have to celebrate that as well. But 5 years of doing Fast Forward Radio here on Blog Talk Radio, 5 years of doing a weekly show, and absolutely something to look forward to every week, something new and interesting, and a fun technical glitch to deal with just about every week. I was thinking about it. We've done almost 250 shows. Almost 250 different things have gone wrong on this show, which is great. But one of the things that has always gone right is the people that we've had on the show, the people who keep coming back, and of course one of our favorites is with us this evening, and that would be PJ Manny. PJ, welcome back to Fast Forward Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I am so honored.
Well, we talked about when we did the 5-year show, we'll get a big group together. We might do that for the 250th show, but we thought, for this, let's just, one or two, and we don't know if it's going to be one or two, people join us and just kind of reflect on how things have gone. But we were saying before the show started, and I don't think we ever figured it out, when was the last time we had you on? It seems like has it been a year since it can't be that long, surely.
Oh, gosh, I can't imagine it's been that long. Has
Stephen,
it?
Stephen, when did we have PJ on? You remember.
I believe... We'll have to go back and look, but I don't think that we've had you on, PJ, in this calendar year.
Wow.
Now, I think it was late last year, maybe around Christmas time or something, that we had you on. But I don't believe that we've had you on in 2012, and that's, it's
too long.
It's
just too long.
It's just been way too long. You always contribute so well to the show, and it's sure good to have you on the show tonight.
We're
well,
very pleased.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be back.
So tell us what's been going on since we last spoke.
Well, since we last spoke, I have been mothering my two teenagers. I have been finishing my novel which we should definitely talk about at some point.
Well, let's
and,
talk about that. That's actually where I was going with that whole
okay,
thing.
Well.
tell us about your novel.
The Country's Club, which is, I like to call it a techno epic, mostly because it covers oh so much. But really, it's a political techno thriller that takes place in the arena of nanotechnology and cognitive technologies. And the best way to describe it is it's kind of a combination of The Count of Monte Cristo and Frankenstein, where you have the the protagonist
that's awesome.
Who is both the doctor and the creature, who is also set on revenge. And
I love that pitch. Are you kidding? You know, The Count of Monte Cristo meets Frankenstein. I'm so sold already. Okay, I want to buy the film rights right
I'm
now.
Buying the movie rights.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's that. I'm very excited. I've putting together a multimedia book where you'll be able to drill down into it online through an ebook and listen to the music that's playing through the protagonist's head. See the research, the real research. Everything I write about actually has a basis in reality. This is all stuff that's coming. And I think that's the really fun part is in with something that's so near future where people would go, oh, my God, that must be impossible, to really show them, no, it's not just possible, it's happening.
Excellent. Well, we're going to have to, when the book comes out, we're going to have you come back on. Stephen and I will be looking forward to getting our copies of it, of course. And,
yes, autographed, I promise. If you can autograph an e-book.
Oh, there must be a way. Surely there is a way. And we'll,
what I'll do is I'll print it out,
you know,
and I'll send it back to you.
Yeah, we can't help but do that. We read a book. We share the whole thing. No, we won't give anything away. But we'll have you back on, and we'll talk about it. And you say it's coming out. When's it going to be available?
Early 2013.
Early 2013. So we're going to hold you to Q1 2013. Is that
you got it?
Is that fair? Okay, cool. So by March 31st, Stephen, we'll have PJ back on to talk about the book. Although hopefully we'll have you back before then too, because I think we've got a lot of catching up to do. A lot of time to cover. Well, we've got speaking of a lot of time to cover, we're scheduled for 90 minutes this evening. We may not run the full 90 minutes. We put together a rather, ambitious list of topics to talk about tonight. So I thought I'd give us plenty of time, and we're just going to be kind of open ended. We'll end the show when we feel that it ends. Actually, we'll end it when Stephen feels that it ends, because he's always the one, you know, running the board over there. In fact, we could be off now. I don't know, Stephen. We still going or?
We're still on. We're still on at present because you haven't bored me yet, Phil. So
okay, yeah. All right. Well, we're gonna test that here in just a moment. I never know if I've been muted. Right? It's always like, are we still? Can everyone still hear me? I don't know. Stephen's over there working his little switches. So I thought I'd start out tonight. I put together a little piece. Explaining, I thought it was high time we explained what this show is about. I give a little spiel at the beginning every week, and we've had quite a bit of meta discourse over the years, Stephen. I think you would agree over the 5 years about what it is that we're talking about and why we do this. But I thought this was an appropriate time to draw some ideas together, and yep. I'm just going to share that. I'm going to talk about what I think fast forward radio means. So if you'll all bear with me. This is going to be Phil sharing some thoughts on what fast-forward radio means. Okay. The human imperative is the relentless drive to improve the human condition. This is the one commandment obeyed by virtually all of humanity for all of human history. Thou shalt improve thine own circumstances, the circumstances of thy family, the circumstances of thy tribe, or the circumstances of thy species. This commandment is pervasive. It is written directly into our DNA. In fact, it is the reason our DNA is what it is. When we grew large brains, when we developed a bipedal stance, when we positioned our thumbs opposably to the rest of our hands, we were carrying out the human imperative through the slow and deliberate process of evolution. The commandment is also embedded in our language, our fundamental thought processes, and virtually everything we do, both consciously and unconsciously. It's at the heart of day-to-day activities like preparing dinner or putting gas in the car, and it's also the principal driver behind those great multi-generational projects called culture, science, technology, and civilization itself. All improvements, great and small, derive from the human imperative. Industrial Revolution? Check. Polio vaccine? Check. Recycled cardboard sleeve that keeps you from burning your hand on your grande cafe Americano? Check. The human imperative is universal, and therefore we are all unavoidably participants. Some people are focused only on improving the circumstances of others, while others are focused exclusively on improving their own circumstances. Most of us are somewhere in between, devoting some measure of our energies to improving the lives of others, whether those others be our own friends and families or communities or humanity as a whole, and devoting the rest of our energy to improving our own lives. Whichever way we focus our efforts, it's important to note that many of us are not terribly good at carrying out the human imperative. Some of us do little or nothing to make things better, while others, unfortunately, move the needle in the wrong direction, actually making the human condition worse. However, the vast majority of both the ineffectives and those who cause real damage are at least trying to improve the condition of at least one human life, if only their own. And as we'll see in a moment, there's more value in any attempt to make anything better, no matter how callous or wrongheaded or even downright evil the approach, than we might otherwise have thought. So, when we set out to improve our own personal circumstances, we can do it one of three ways: at the expense of others, without regard to the circumstances of others, or by way of improving the circumstances of others. And everybody likes that third way of improving their own lives because it's the nice way. It's the win-win scenario. I mean, the nicest thing of all is just work on improving everyone else's life. But if you're going to work on your own, then if you can do it in such a way that you improve other circumstances, that's perfect. In The Rational Optimist, Matt Ridley argues that trade is a key driver of progress because it's a means of improving one's own circumstances while improving the circumstances of others. Obviously, it's much easier to get people on board with your plan to improve your own life if that plan involves some means by which they can improve their lives. And every offer to do business of any kind involves just that, a proposition to the other person about something you think will be of value to them. So the more trade that takes place in the world, the more lives that get improved, theoretically, at least. Of course, not every deal is a good deal, and sometimes the unscrupulous take advantage of the unsuspecting, leaving them with less money or less whatever was being exchanged and no improved circumstances to speak of. Plus, we're often wrong about what will represent a true improvement in our lives. That is to say, sometimes we just don't know what's good for us. Moreover, individual acts of improvement often lead to unforeseen or ignored negative consequences that outweigh the benefit of the improvement that we were looking for. So, to sum up, well-intentioned actions lead to negative results. So you introduce rabbits as a food source in Australia, and lacking any significant predators, they become a major feral pest. Or prohibition of alcohol is implemented in the U.S. to create a decent, clean, and sober society, and it leads to rampant lawlessness and the empowerment of organized crime. Or, as we've discussed recently in some detail on this show, student loan programs are introduced as a means of making college education widely accessible, and it leads to skyrocketing tuition costs and college graduates, and worse yet, non-graduates, saddled with decades of debt and the overall reduction of options and quality of life that goes with that. This is called the law of unintended consequences, and it lies behind virtually all of the man-made challenges we face. Pollution of and damage to the environment, overpopulation, depletion of resources, these are all direct results of human success. They represent the downside of the human imperative. Now, here's where the story gets kind of strange. Sometimes, when people act in spite of the interests of others, or with no regard to the interests of others, or even in willful opposition to the interests of others, they end up making improvements that one day improve the circumstances of others anyway. Or, put more simply, bad behavior sometimes leads to positive results. We saw how good behavior or attempted good behavior leads to bad results. Well, the opposite is also true. For example, when you do a search that uses Google Satellite View, or when you use GPS function on your smartphone, do you ever stop and think about the tremendous debt these technologies owe to Nazi Germany? The satellite age was initially enabled by rocket technology, derivative of rockets developed by the Nazis in the hopes of raining destruction down on Great Britain and eventually the United States. So does this mean that Nazi Germany was really okay deep down and that no one should think badly of them because, after all, they gave us the V2 rocket? Well, of course not. It was an evil regime that committed acts of unspeakable evil. That's really the point. That's why it seems surprising that we should be enjoying the fruits of Nazi military R&D all these years later. But it's really not surprising at all. Nazi rocket technology represents the flip side of the law of unintended consequences. Just as unforeseen negative consequences arise from what were intended to be good actions, unforeseen benefits arise from evil and despicable actions. The difference is that benefits are good and tend to persist no matter where they come from, whereas the problems that arise simply demand the development of still more improvements. All of which explains why, in spite of the very real problems we have faced and continue to face and will continue to face, the evidence is clear that the human condition has improved vastly over the millennia and is continuing to do so. Apparently, there is enough cumulative good in the improvements we've made, the ones that really are improvements, to outweigh all the mistakes we've made and the crimes we've committed. And that's a staggering thought when you consider just how horrifying and appalling some of those mistakes and crimes have been. The simple observation that the human condition has improved, and make no mistake, it is an observation, it's not a hypothesis or a bit of wishful thinking, combined with the logical projection that that trend of improvement will continue, constitutes a complete departure from the conventional wisdom surrounding what's happening in the world and what's likely to happen next. The story of the human imperative is the story of rapidly expanding human understanding and capability, of improvements to the human condition run wild. Our world is getting better all the time. We are getting better all the time. And one of the things we're getting better at is getting better. We're talking about a virtuous cycle, a truly virtuous cycle if we take into account research showing that human beings are becoming less violent and more cooperative over time, as documented in Steven Pinker's excellent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. Improvements to the human condition continue to reinforce each other with greater impact and at a higher rate of speed with each new iteration. Where can such a cycle possibly be leading us? And that, my friends, is the question that Fast Forward Radio is here to ask. The question that we've been asking for more than 7 years now and that we've been asking weekly for the past 5 years. And, of course, we're not just here to ask the question, we're here to try to answer it. If you'd like to hear the full answer, as we've articulated it so far, all of the shows are archived, and as we calculated a couple of weeks ago, 10 days of nonstop Fast Forward Radio listening will get you more or less caught up. Over those 10 days, you'll hear the thoughts of some of the most brilliant people alive, often in their own words. You'll hear about driverless cars, 3D printers, universal assemblers, artificial intelligence, utility fog, vat meat, life extension, abundance, alternative energy, virtual worlds, the death of employment, the coffee shopification of everything, space travel, time travel, the simulation hypothesis, the omega point, the technological singularity, and, of course, sex with robots. Okay, Stephen, that's 2 weeks in a row. It's not a trend unless I talk about it next week, too. Okay, just FYI.
Okay, so far so good, right?
All right. Okay. You will hear about a relentless and accelerating wave of technological, cultural, and social change that is driving the next stage of human evolution. You'll get a glimpse of a world where the boundaries have been reset or removed, where the possibilities are so vast that it's intimidating, dizzying, even to try to contemplate them. And maybe you'll get a glimpse of a future version of yourself, happier, smarter, more capable than you ever thought possible, a sexy immortal billionaire with superpowers, in the making at least. Or, if you prefer the short version, it's simply this. We are witnesses to a world transformed. For those who don't know, the word speculist, which obviously is the name of the blog from which this program arose, means one who observes. But as human beings, we're called to be, I think, no, destined to be more than witnesses. The human imperative impels us all to be participants in the transformation of the world. As Shakespeare wrote in Hamlet, we know what we are, but not what we may be. The question of what comes next, of what we do next, of who we may yet be, that is a question worth pursuing, and we're in pursuit. An unimaginable future lies before us. Our challenge is to try to imagine it anyway, and then to try to make it real. If we can imagine it, and we can make it real, then there's only one thing left to do. Live to see it.
Awesome.
And that,
Bill,
my friends, is what Fast Forward Radio is about.
That was great.
Yeah. You had to put that Linus line at the end, right?
Yes. Exactly. That's the Charlie Brown Christmas.
That's Charlie Brown is what Fast Forward Radio is all about.
That's what the show is about.
I love that. That's excellent. It's excellent. You know, the way I see it, we're looking forward in the future, and, you know, it's like there's some futures that appeal to us, some that don't, and if we're lucky, every now and then we can contribute to pruning some of the branches off of off the tree that, you know, maybe we don't, you know, down the road to things we don't want, you know, futures that, that don't look good. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think we'll get to a good future. I think we have choices about how hard it's going to be. That's the trick. That's the thing we want to avoid. So, some familiar ideas just kind of came rising to the surface and came together in a new way as I was putting that together. But I feel like that could almost be the spiel at the beginning of every show, but it would kind of cut into the show. So
a little bit, yeah. But nevertheless, it was great. Thanks, Bill.
I'll only do that once every 5 years or so, I promise. But with that in mind, let's talk about those improvements, or you know, if anyone who has an opposing view, let's talk about what's been happening over the past 5 years. I called the show 5 years that changed the world, and some people took that to mean that I was saying that fast forward radio has been the driver behind the changes to the world, and I didn't really mean that. And also, I'm ambiguous as to whether the 5 years that changed the world are the 5 years that we've just passed through, or is it the 5 years that we're about to come into? We could go either way, and I think we're going to talk about both. But how has the world changed over the past 5 years? I've just talked quite a bit, so I'll give it to you guys, Stephen or PJ. What's the big change that's occurred in the world over that half of a decade?
Well, for me, probably the biggest change is the wireless world and personal computing. But I mean personal, not on a PC, but on a phone, on, you know, headsets, et cetera. There's a mobileness now to our ability to telecommunicate that with iPads, et cetera, and now from Google Glasses and a whole variety of things that are just about to all hit quite hard, it'll be remarkable that miniaturization of the internet world. Any smaller and we'll have to start putting it inside us, won't we?
Yeah. Even more than we already are. Well, as we discussed before the show. Well, I had that one on my list too. Stephen, do you have a response to that or another item?
All my thunder is just completely, you know, stolen. I'm done. I'm gonna be quiet for a second. No,
mute yourself. Okay.
That is absolutely the biggest change in the last 5 years. We went from like a personal computer like society. I mean, and our technology became much more intimate when we're carrying it around with us all the time. You know, I joked 7 years ago when we in one of our very first fast forward radios, I joked that I think of Google as part of my brain. If I can learn something, PJ, and you know, in the same day that I have, you know, the question floats through my mind, then, you know, that was pretty great, I thought, back in, you know, what was that, about 2005. I don't, you know, but I don't have to wait until I get to a computer now. You know, if I'm driving, you know, I could be stopped at a red light, and, you know, I shouldn't, but, you know, I could ask Siri, and I could probably get a response before the light turns green on most anything that I happen to think of. So, It's a much different world now, and in a way, you know, it's not that we have greater brain power in our skulls, but it's not, our brains are no longer just in our skulls anymore. We live in a bigger mental world than even I went to, you know, college in, or any, you know, just the recent past.
Well, it's also the amount of people that, and therefore the amount of data that you have access
That's
to.
Right.
I think I just read that the population of the world who are now on the internet doubled in that 5 years.
Right.
Yeah.
It's amazing, isn't it?
That's amazing. Another 5 years, it'll probably quadruple.
Can you imagine what a change it is? You know, it's a huge change for us here in the United States. Imagine what a change it is for a Maasai warrior. You know, they absolutely living in a rural setting, in a very, you know, maybe not quite a hunter-gatherer, maybe an agrarian society. And then, bang, this hits. And it's just absolutely changes the world overnight in ways that it may be a little bit difficult for us to understand.
Well, here's the thing. I've got a link I'll share from Flurry blog. They did a study, and I think the real driver here is one particular piece of technology, although an awful lot of things converged to make that possible. But let me ask you a question. When did you get your first smartphone? Stephen, when did you get your first? Your iPhone was your first smartphone, or were you a BlackBerry guy before that?
I don't know. iPhone was my first smartphone, and I believe it was actually fairly recently. I got a 3S. I would imagine that would have been about 2009, maybe mm-hmm. 2000, maybe 2008. But the first iPhone was released in 2007, so it couldn't have been. It had to be more recently. It had to be about 2010.
Okay.
I
got my first iPhone.
Not having it. It's amazing.
Yeah, well, I can't either. I got my first phone around then, to 2009, 2010, something like that. How about you, PJ?
I think it was more like 2008, 2009. Yeah, about then.
I remember you
I had it instantly.
Yeah, you and I, we were at the, I think it was Convergence 08, and we were going somewhere. And I was using your iPhone to do GPS navigation. Do you remember that? We were driving someplace.
Oh, there you go. Then that's when it was.
That's the first time I ever held one in my hand. Your iPhone was the first one I ever held. I was like, wow, this is so cool. And I didn't get one until a couple years later. But all three of us are actually part of this wave because, Stephen, you pointed out that the iPhone was introduced in 2007. And the period of the past 5 years, the period since 2007, has been the age of the smartphone. It has been this incredible adoption of this technology globally. And here's a little snippet from that blog post. He says, the rate of iOS and Android device adoption has surpassed that of any consumer technology in history. Compared to recent technology, smart device adoption is being adopted 10 times faster than that of 80s PC revolution, 2 times faster than that of the 90s internet boom, and 3 times faster than that of the recent social network adoption. 5 years into the smart device growth curve, expansion of this new technology is rapidly expanding beyond early adopter markets such as North America and Western Europe, creating a true worldwide addressable market. Overall, we estimate that there are over 640 million iOS and Android devices in use during the month of July 2012. So, I mean, it's just, it's huge. And, PJ, to your point about people on the Internet, everybody who gets a smartphone is on the Internet, right? It's no longer just – they used to talk about there's this rate of people who didn't used to have phones getting phones, and there's this rate of people who didn't used to, have a connection to the Internet or computer technology who get that. With a smartphone, it was all those problems solved at the same time. Right. Suddenly people who didn't have a way of calling or who didn't have a way of getting on the Internet, all those problems got solved. And it's an absolutely seminal and transformational technology. And I think we're only going to see bigger and bigger things with it in the next 5 years.
Or smaller and smaller, as the case may be.
Exactly. Good point. Yeah. Bigger and bigger numbers of people with smaller
and
smaller.
Right, smaller and smaller devices.
People with big fingers like me going, I just can't make anything happen here.
I have tiny fingers, and I still have a hard time texting with my iPhone. So I'm looking
That's
forward to seeing
Google
if the 5 solves that problem.
Yes,
yeah,
well, Siri
Google
helps
goggles
me a lot.
Or the Google glasses, whatever they want to call it. That's why that's going to be so huge. The whole world will be keyboard then.
Yes.
And that'll make it easier on us that have tiny fingers.
Yeah, well, we did that a while back. Do you remember that piece I wrote, Big is the New Small? That we're going to have interfaces that are just be huge. People be using their arms and legs and kicking stuff. It's going to be great. did anybody have anything other than that as the big or a big change over the past 5 years? Other items?
I have several, Phil.
What else you got?
Let me just run through some things that have launched. Maybe not in the last 5 years, but certainly in the last 7 since we started doing the show. Completely at the very beginning of the show. YouTube launched in 2005. That was the same year we did our first program and kind of on a monthly or every other monthly basis back in 2005. Facebook launched just the year before in 2004. Twitter launched in 2006. And then the iPhone launched in 2007, and the Android, believe it or not, the Android smartphone did not launch until 2010, believe it or not. It doesn't seem right.
Was introduced in 08. It was introduced in 08, but I think they didn't, you know what I mean? Just like it was announced, the way the iPhone was announced, and then it wasn't available for a little while after that. Same with the same with the Droid. Yeah.
Well,
yeah, that is hard to believe.
Things,
they've only been around a couple of years. Good grief.
And absolutely the best Android smartphones are now competing. They're competitive now. For a while, it seemed like the iPhone had the an insurmountable advantage, but that's not necessarily the case anymore. There are people that really swear by their Androids, and I think actually they're outselling iPhones quite nicely in most other countries outside the United States. So that's a big deal too.
Okay. Anything else on your end, PJ? Are there other big developments over the past 5 years?
Well, I think back to two things. One, I think we should not discount the entire social media arena.
It's huge, yeah.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary. The way we communicate now is, I don't know about you, but I use Facebook as much for communicating now with people as I do my email. And in some cases, I have friends who don't answer their emails, but they answer their Facebook. That's been fascinating to watch the growth of communities, the reigniting of friendships, the reunion of people. That's been extraordinary in a way that I think touches people's lives in almost a I want to say insidious, but I don't mean it in a negative connotation.
But in a very deep way, you're right.
In
a way that really gets into your life, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's true. We have seen that external world of the computer get more and more into our personal lives. And I think it's really interesting you mentioned that about Facebook. How about this one, where people expect you to tweet them to communicate with them? I'm like, what? That one just blows me away. It's like, you don't give me an email address, you give me a Twitter account. Oh my!
That's the step too far for me.
That makes me feel old when they do that.
Absolutely.
Is that a thing? Do people do that? I'm like, do you have phone number by any chance? Can I text you? That's cool, right? If I text. when you think about how much communicating do you do today that 5 years ago either barely existed as an option or didn't exist or you wouldn't have thought of doing. And yet you do it without even thinking about it now. I mean, it's really pretty remarkable. Time was email replaced voicemail as this big thing for business communications, you know. And now suddenly it's, I'll put it up on your LinkedIn, you know.
Right.
Or, yeah, I'll put it up on your Facebook. There's so many different ways for people to communicate with each other. You almost wonder if the idea of there being a standard is going to go away. That's almost kind of a scary thought, isn't it?
I think people are going to find their place to communicate. And I do think the difference between something like Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn as examples, I mean, they're all very distinct ways of presenting oneself.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're comfortable in the 140-character space, hell, I can barely say my name in 140 characters, then that's one thing. But you'll find – I think it will end up eventually becoming tribal in a funny way. I think there'll be people who use all of them and they're extremely adept. But I'm already seeing it, the people who feel more comfortable on Twitter versus the people who feel more comfortable on Facebook versus the people who feel more comfortable on LinkedIn, and that's really their only form of non-email or voice communication. It'll be interesting to see as we've opened it up so much. You know, I get contacted by people from all over the world that I've never met because they read something I posted or were in a group together, et cetera. There's an incredible flow of information. But if I'm doing that on Facebook and I'm not doing it on LinkedIn, who are the people that I'm missing there?
Right.
And how will that group shape that form of communication in the future? And how will those forms of communication continue to evolve differently?
Absolutely. It's astounding to think about. Well, I remember when Twitter first came out, and when I first encountered it, up close and personal. It was probably 07. I was at an event, and people were tweeting it. And I couldn't at that time get my head wrapped around Twitter. And I have to admit that to this day, I don't have my head completely. I mean, I use it, but I'm still like, why do we do this? But I remember thinking, this is just the oddest thing ever. And at first, I thought it was just for people using their phones. But then I said, oh, they do it on their computers too, and I get it. It's this, it's this way of sharing short messages, and it's microblogging and that whole thing. But it seemed like this arcane little side technology that had caught on and would be kind of a fad, kind of a flap. For a while, and then it would go away. And like earlier today, I'm reading this story, this big controversy over some tweets that Jack Welch made. Okay, he's talking about the unemployment numbers, the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers from last week. Which we'll not get into any of that. I don't care about the merits of the case. To me, the astounding thing is Jack Welch uses Twitter. He has a Twitter feed. People follow Jack Welch on Twitter. You think about this old guy, this old guard business guy. And him and everybody else in the world, right? They all have Twitter feeds now, and it's really remarkable when you think about this this odd little technology that has become this amazingly pervasive thing.
Absolutely. When you also realize that someone like Lady Gaga has 30 million followers.
I know. Isn't that weird? Gosh.
That's extraordinary.
And that she would she'd have the biggest following of anybody. I would not have guessed it would be her.
Well, the top five are all singers.
Okay.
Well, I can tell you the first
thing
I do every day is I check
Katy Perry and Rihanna.
As I check Lady Gaga's Twitter feed, that's the first thing I do. I don't want
to. And then Rihanna. Rihanna,
later
brings
in the day.
Up number five.
Yeah.
I drink some coffee.
Bieber.
Justin Bieber. Okay. So anyway, I had a couple of others that are not as big, but I think that speak to things that are coming soon. Speak to big things that are coming soon. First is the something we talked about in our email leading up to this show. The question was raised 5 years ago: did they even have driverless cars back then? Kind of as a joke, and the fact is they didn't. And over the past 5 years, we've seen this idea enter into the public consciousness. We've seen the technological proof of concept demonstration of it by Google that is undeniable that this will work, and we've seen governments actually lining up and saying, yes, we're going to build create infrastructure for this, at least legal infrastructure for this, to allow this to happen. An idea that I think most people hadn't even heard of 5 years ago. It was something science fiction buffs like us had thought about, but regular people hadn't thought about that much. And now it is an idea that has emerged into public consciousness.
I'm sorry, Phil. One of the early things that you and I blogged about quite a bit at the Speculist in the early days of the Speculist was the DARPA Grand Challenge. We wrote a lot about that when it was happening. And, initially the first DARPA Grand Challenge, this was a prize. It seems like innovation is often driven by prizes. Historically, it's happened quite a bit. But, they had all these different universities competing. And all they were doing is driving cars off-road. You didn't have to deal with the traffic, inner-city, stoplights and pedestrians and everything else. This was just getting a vehicle from point A to point B off road, and at the first year was not all that encouraging because I think half the teams barely got off the starting line without something bad going wrong. But it got better, and it got better fast. And now we're seeing these Google vehicles on the road in Nevada and now in California. PJ, I believe that. Yeah, they legalized it recently.
Yes, in fact, 2015 is when I believe is when they're going to be fully legal.
Okay.
Phasing it in. That's interesting. That we're going to revisit that when we talk about what's going to happen over the next 5 years. And I think that is an example of a change in thinking that has occurred. I mean, that's a really good one because there has been this exciting proof of concept from Google. But I think that generally, everything I was just talking about, maybe not under the name the human imperative, but the whole notion that things are changing rapidly and that things are going in some unexpected directions has more cachet in the public awareness than it did 5 years ago. That somebody like Ray Kurzweil shows up on Stephen Colbert and shows up on Jon Stewart, Aubrey de Grey making the rounds on 60 Minutes and programs like that. When a book like The Rational Optimist or Abundance, when those books became big bestsellers, there's this dawning awareness that things are changing, that a whole set of expectations about what the future is going to be and how things have to work out are really not correct, that the conventional wisdom isn't right and that there's a very different way of looking at things. And I think that's really exciting. I think it's exciting that people are starting to pay attention to these kinds of issues and starting to see these things differently than they did before.
Absolutely. Crowdfunding, Phil, that's something that seems to have popped up in the last 5 years that we didn't have before. And I think that's a huge deal. A Kickstarter and many websites, PJ, you can probably help me name them, that are more aimed at funding the beginning of businesses in developing countries. I think that's an awesome, awesome development, and that's going to be huge going forward. I think the SEC needs to rethink the rules on allowing people to profit from these small little ventures. But basically, allow the entire world to be venture capitalists streamline the rules to allow that. And it's a big deal.
No, I think it's wonderful. And in fact, I will be the first person to admit that about 5 years ago when someone said, "What about crowdfunding?" I said, "Tish tosh, impossible." One of those things where you go, you know, wow, futurist.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that has truly been an extraordinary change. And I see so many of my friends doing it. It's so heartening to see their success in such a variety of fields. That's even more fascinating to me, from arts and movies and communications to all kinds of gadgetry and, you know, widgets, et cetera. It's fantastic.
Yeah, the model is made for backing creative projects, so you can immediately see the connection when someone's talking about we're going to make a movie, or I'm trying to put a book out, or I want to do a show in a gallery or something like that. And you immediately go, oh, okay, well, we have this idea of people who patronize art. Well, that doesn't sound right. Act as patrons for artists, and it's a familiar model. But that model, actually, back in the day, also supported inventors. It supported scientists, and now we're seeing that reintroduced. And Stephen, to your point, what you legally can't do is get a share of a business this way, right? That's
right.
That's the part that is missing.
It's a little frustrating. I would love for there to be a Kickstarter for the next Apple that I could look at and say, yeah, I believe in you guys. I'm going to put $1,000 into you, and then lo and behold, nine times out of ten I get it wrong. But what about that tenth time? When
exactly.
I get it right, and to me, allow that. I think the SEC needs to rethink it. And maybe there should be limits.
Stephen?
I think we've lost him.
Oh, Stephen. Well, I think what he was saying, and I'm sure he'll be back with us momentarily, was that there would need to be limits on the amount you would put in. It might be, he had said $1,000, and I think that might be actually be the cap, right? That somebody might say, well, you can buy in up to a certain amount of money, and no more. And it would be a new kind of security. It wouldn't really be a security. It's more like a very speculative, participatory business venture. It's like becoming a partner in a business, but we don't currently have a legal infrastructure that supports it, and that's why Kickstarter and Indiegogo and the rest of them all talk in terms of projects rather than businesses, and they all talk about giving you some kind of reward rather than giving you some kind of payout. But I think it would be really interesting to see that model change somewhat. Well, I had one other that I thought of, which is really the true beginnings of the privatization of space launch. And we've seen that really over the last couple of years, and here over the past year, we've seen some really exciting stuff. And it's nice because this is one. Just in the past few days, we've seen major stuff going on with the Dragon arriving at the International Space Station. But the launch of SpaceX as, you know, not just a viable technology, but a viable functioning entity that I think really is going to be pivotal to getting people and materiel into space over the coming years is that's a major shift. I think it's a shift that we've probably are overdue for seeing happen, and it happens in that same 5-year period where we saw the last space shuttle launch, and we saw recently those very poignant pictures of the space shuttles being moved to their final homes, right? Carried around on those 747s and landing wherever it is that they're going. It's like farewell to the space shuttle and hello to whatever this new age of getting stuff into space is going to be.
Absolutely. In fact, I was one of those many people standing in a canyon in Los Angeles. In fact, I was probably one of the first people to take a picture of it entering L.A. County as it flew right by. And it was very emotional for me because it really did represent the end of an era and the beginning of something else. And you realize how long that era lasted. It was quite something. So it will be fascinating to see how this new economic model for space opens up opportunities that were never there before.
Yeah, I think we're gonna. Oh, Stephen, you're back with us.
Hopefully, that was the glitch for this week.
Well, there you go. 245. Okay, we got five more to go. Did you have something you wanted to add on privatization of space launch?
Well, absolutely, it's huge. You know, this was an idea, but it was almost a crackpot idea 5 years ago, wasn't it?
Right.
You know, it was one of those things that, you know, some guy was laboring in his garage, and yeah, I'm gonna put this capsule that I built out of plywood into space, and you know, it was more to it than that, but it was really kind of sort of a crackpot kind of thing, but. Now it's big business. SpaceX is huge. They just arrived this morning. Their first, you may have mentioned this, Phil, their first mission, official mission, was docked with the International Space Station this morning. And so, it's just the birth of a brand new industry that's going to be huge. Within 5 years, I say, Phil, we're going to see the beginning of asteroid mining. I think that's very possible, and there's a huge amount of wealth that could be brought to our home planet that way. So it's exciting times for space.
Yeah, big stuff going on there. Well, okay, before you've kind of jumped now to the what's going to happen in the next 5 years, but that's okay if no one has any other things that happened in the last 5 years. We'll give Stephen
I've got a transition one that might
give
us a good transition.
Go ahead.
We've often had, in the past, we've had replacement body parts that have been mechanical. We've had mechanical hearts where we've done transplants of organs from cadavers, people who've just passed to the human body. But what we see now are replacement parts that you can grow.
Yeah,
right.
That's been, to me, extraordinary. I mean, I just saw the picture yesterday of the woman who has an ear growing on her arm.
Right.
To replace
freaky,
her.
Isn't it? I mean, it's wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And so many organs now are being generated through stem cells, through scaffolding, through growing it on yourself, or from parts, from using your own stem cells, et cetera, that's been a huge transition.
It's a major thing, and I think you're right to point that one out as one that we'll see big stuff happening in the next 5 years.
Yes.
That's related, one that's like on the cusp. Go ahead, Stephen.
related field. Ethical meat is what they is what they often call themselves. What we've in the past called that meat.
Mm-hmm.
There are companies now seriously working on this issue, and one of them here, it's the Meadow or whatever. I'm looking here at the it's Modern Meadow is what they're calling themselves. You know, instead of having a real meadow with cows on it or something, the Modern Meadow is more like a lab. And the first product is interesting. I thought this was interesting. They're going to be producing leather. Turns out leather is produced artificially that is convincing and is like the real thing. It's a whole lot easier to do than appetizing meat. But
right.
They're going to do that first, and then. And continue to work on the meat problem, which has turned out to be, a cow is a hard thing to, it's a proof of concept. Think of it, the cow is the proof of concept on how to make a steak, right? It can be done. Now we just need to figure out how to duplicate it in a way that doesn't involve the death of an egg. So.
You know, I just had an inspiration. I just had a thought about that because it's really interesting that you mentioned that that leather is a lot easier to make than that meat.
Right.
And yeah. Perhaps one reason that that's true is that we've been making artificial leather for a long time.
maybe so. Maybe they. Maybe
they. I mean, they've been making patent leather for 100 years, right? It goes back a long way, and so they probably already had a lot of. Ideas about how they could take the real stuff and reform it into something that looks like leather. Well, there are in Southeast Asia, in Malaysia, these vegetarian Chinese restaurants where they make food that looks exactly like meat. Okay, I don't know what they make it out of. They make it out of wheat and rice and soybeans and it looks and tastes exactly like the real thing. I think that they need to bring some of these chefs in from some of these restaurants who make these vegetarian food and have them show you how to make artificial meat out of that meat, because probably what they're trying to do is they're trying to get it exactly right. And what they really need to do is they need to make a reasonable facsimile out of what they're able to produce. They probably haven't involved any artists in the project yet. That's
right.
Probably.
Oh, but I bet there are a bunch of chefs all just waiting in line.
Yeah, they want to get their hands on that.
They want to try it, sure.
See if they can see if they can make something appetizing out of it. Well, I'm
Peter
game. I'll try
this,
it.
By the way.
What's that?
Peter Thiel is a big backer of,
there you go.
Of stuff. So just a little factoid there.
So that's bound to go somewhere. Okay. Well, here's one.
There's some money behind it.
Here's one that I've got. I think 5 years, and Stephen, I believe this falls within one of your prediction windows. I think within 5 years we will see some true initial breakthrough with life extension. Now, I've got a link here. I'll put it in the chat room. Isagenics is selling a supplement they call Product B, which they claim lengthens telomeres and reverses aging, that it actually produces telomerase and it makes your telomeres longer, which is one big claim. And then that having that happen starts to make you starts to slow down or even reverse aging, which is another huge claim. I'm not here as a representative of Isagenics or to say that that's true. But I am going to say that something along those lines, we'll see something along those lines in the next 5 years, something that actually is a step towards reversing aging or radically slowing aging or even moderately slowing aging, but something that we haven't seen up to this point that addresses aging as a holistic problem, I predict, within 5 years.
Yeah. And I have a prediction, Phil, that when it shows up, it'll initially be for the treatment of either diabetes, obesity, or perhaps cancer.
If it's not a supplement, it will have to be, right? If it's a medicine, who were we talking about? We had a guest on who was saying that just not too long ago, that you'll never get it passed as a drug unless it addresses some existing condition, because aging is not considered a disease that you can have a cure for.
Well, you know, we could just say to the FDA, you know, people that are in their 20s, they don't get sick as much from anything. So it's a treatment for everything. So we all choose to be biologically in our 20s. I don't know. It's a bit like the SEC needing to be rewritten to allow crowdfunding. Some things are just going to have to, it seems to me that government moves so much slower at a snail's pace by comparison to the enabling technologies that are hitting like all at once. And it's just sort of the way it is, I guess. So.
Yep. PJ, prediction for the next 5 years?
Well, related, I was going to say genetic medicine, I think, will finally be realized. I know people have been saying that for a while, and it's kind of like, it's always 20 years out, 20 years out is the curse of future prediction. But I really do think that we're going to see in the next 5 years some major breakthroughs in both the diagnosis and the personalization of genetic medicine.
Yeah, I agree completely. It's the price of sequencing DNA just doesn't seem to, there doesn't seem to be a floor to that price, does it?
Price and time. I mean, the amount of time now.
Yeah.
Now it's 50 hours to sequence an entire genome, and most of that time is human analysis time. They've actually cut down, I think, almost half of it is people having to physically deal with analyzing it and giving an answer from a human. The other half of the time is the computer and the processing.
Right.
So
yeah.
Once they've cracked programming the analysis, we're going to have within a day the processing of a genome.
You know what is neat to me about this, PJ, is that, a few years ago, maybe somebody that's very, very wealthy, Steve Jobs, for example, had his genome sequenced in an effort to fight his cancer.
Mm.
And, the problem was that although he was very wealthy and so could afford it, so few people had, their genome sequenced that the sort of personalized medicine that it take to do something with that and to help him just wasn't available.
Well, because you have to analyze a genome, mm-hmm. you really need it in the aggregate. You need to see all these people who have X have this genome. All these people who have Y have this, I'm not meaning X and Y, but you know what I mean. Have this genome. You need all that data, and we're only just starting to accumulate it.
Yes, we're at the beginning of something huge on that. And when we crack the $1,000 genome, which is next year,
right?
It's coming very quickly. Then everybody will have their genome sequenced, and then once everybody has their genome sequenced, it'll start beginning to be really important to have your genome sequenced because there'll be so much that can be done with it. It's The utility of it is going to go up even as the price goes down.
Yeah. Well, everyone who gets it sequenced, the utility goes up and the cost goes down. And it's going to hit a tipping point very quickly where it will be expected. It will be like having your blood type. I mean, it's just like, well, how can you get medical treatment if you don't know what your blood type is? It will be at that level before we know it. But obviously, so much richer a set of information to deal with than blood type is, and so much more important to the kinds of treatments and the options that it's going to open up for us. Okay, Stephen, what else you got? Other predictions for 5 years?
Oh, let's see here. I was just going to say the treatments for aging. I believe that 2014 was the year that I had way back when had said that by this point we'll have something. So I mean that's we're talking just a couple of years from now. So
yep, so it's definitely in that window. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely on board for that. Let's just see here. One thing that I've noticed in the last 5 years, I would say before 5 years ago, Phil, the idea of e-books. Were a little bit foreign to me, and I didn't know if I'd ever really enjoy reading a book that way.
Right.
And I think that you only got on board with ebooks about 6 months ago? I mean, it's kind of a
I got my Kindle Fire about a year ago now. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And let me just ask, as a percentage of your reading, how much of your reading do you do on it?
Virtually all. I'm actually to the point where, I mean, I got a bookshelf here, and I go and I look at books that I want to read, and then I go and download the Kindle version of it.
It's funny. You have the actual paper book in your house, and you don't.
Yes.
You don't.
And I don't read it. I'm like, no, the light's not that good. I'm getting the Kindle version. Yeah. So I am as persuaded a devotee of as ebooks as you'll ever find. I'm completely sold on the idea. I love them.
Yeah, me too. And I think that that's what improvements can you see with ebooks in the next few years. I would say we're going to see flexible displays. You know, that's, and it's going to get cheaper and cheaper to the point that it's going to be almost disposable. You know, it's, and it's going to be, I would say that, you know, the large bookstores that I love so much, they're going to go away, and that's a shame. I've always enjoyed those. But again, that's part of the coffee shop of everything.
They'll come back as coffee shops, right? That's
exactly.
They'll
Barnes and Nobles will shrink down to just their coffee shop, and they'll be okay, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's a big one. I've got the continued coffee shopification. I don't have that on my list, but you mention it, and it actually relates to one that I do have on my list, which is along with the coffee shopification of everything, and particularly things like retail and education. I think we're going to see the real emergence of widespread acceptance of and use of 3D printers. And
yeah.
I'll give a coin toss as to whether we all have one in our homes 5 years from now. I think it's very likely that we might.
I suspect, Phil, that the coin toss will seem funny to us in 5 years.
Yeah.
Because we'll all have them. In fact, my kids are trying to talk me into one for Christmas.
Seriously. Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
Wow.
You'll have one in 2 months. There you go.
Right.
Yeah. And there is one that's you know, it has limited function. It doesn't do a whole lot, but it's only about $350. And shoot, yeah, I'm gonna get it for them and let them toy around with it, you know. And it's anything to encourage their creativity, I think. And it's going to be fun. And I shouldn't act like it's something I'm not going to play with, because I'll be right in there with them.
Yeah, no, he's just doing it for the kids. You know.
Yeah, I'm just doing this for the kids, honey.
It's all about the boys, for sure. Well, I've got a couple others. One of them is really going to blow your mind, so I'm going to save it for very last until everyone has used all of theirs. But one other that I have that I'll mention right now is I think we're right within the window that John Smart always predicted for the conversational user interface, and I think we'll see it happen. I think Siri is the opening round, and we're gonna see her evolve, or her colleagues evolve into a true conversational user interface. I mean, we're pretty close now. It's pretty amazing to pick up your phone and say, and I'm not talking about something I have in my contacts or anything, right? The other day I just said, hey, what's the phone number for India's palace? And boom, she's like, you mean the one over there on Arapahoe Road? And I'm like, yes, that's exactly here. You want me to dial it for you? Yes, I do. I mean, that's getting very close to just having a conversation with the computer, and the computer understands. And my 3-year-old and I are having loads of fun with Siri, having conversations with her, because she comes up with great questions to ask her. You know, what's your favorite color, and what's your favorite song? And there's a lot of scripted answers to some of those questions. But if you get a minute, ask Siri if she knows HAL 9000. I'm not going to tell you. I think it's...
I love that.
It's worth asking that particular question.
My kids somehow knew that was a funny question to ask. As soon as I brought home the new iPhone, they asked it. Funny answer that I
okay,
want,
so you know,
I
so you know, I, the answer is
I
awesome. I'm not going to say everybody's got to try it out for themselves. but I think
that's so cool. I mean, I'm driving down the road, and you know, one of the things, text and drive, kids, you know, just don't do it.
Right.
And so I pick up my phone, and I just hit the little button, and it bleeps at me, and I say, send them that to Carolyn, da 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 da. And here's the message I want, and it repeated the message back to me, and I said, yes, that's it, and it sent it. And, you know, that's that was awesome. Not, you know, not taking my eyes off the road at all. So that's it's just very cool what this voice interface will do for us.
Yeah, I think it's going to be it's going to really personalize the relationship between the human and the machine. PJ, you were talking earlier about how the technology is working its way deeper into our personal lives, and I think this is another way that we sort of begin to bond with the technology in a way that we haven't before, because it's more like we're dealing with another person.
Even more remarkable is that your 3-year-old will never know that there was a time before that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To her, that's completely normal. Yeah. That I can just pick up my phone and say, play A Bushel and a Peck, and the music starts playing, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's amazing. Okay, other predictions for the next 5 years? Before I blow your minds.
Throw it to you.
What's that?
I was saying, PJ, I'm going to throw it to you. I suppose we've mentioned the mining of asteroids. I mentioned that. Okay, so basically I guess it's time for our minds to be blown, Phil, unless PJ has something.
No, all I was going to say is that the only thing I absolutely know to expect is that the change is going to come faster over the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. That's the one thing we can absolutely count on. And that's the perfect introduction for the one I'm going to give you. Have you guys heard of Rose's Law?
No.
No.
Rose's Law is the quantum computer equivalent of Moore's Law.
Ah, yes. Now,
Okay,
I did hear about it, Phil. But go ahead. Yeah. Awesome.
Okay, so basically, we've got Professor David Deutsch at Oxford, who says that quantum computers have the potential to solve problems that would take a classical computer longer than the age of the universe, which is really interesting to kind of put your head around that. And Jordy Rose has been doing the math on quantum computers. He shows where we are now. He's laid it out in a logarithmic line chart, and it's up on Flickr, this picture, and I'll go ahead and put this in the chat room for everyone to look at this. But basically, this is the Moore's Law curve for quantum computers, and Rose's Law tells us that we'll get from the and I can't say off the top of my head how many qubits we're at and we're getting to, but it's been this progression from 1 to 2 and from 2 to 4, and you think, well, that's really nice, but it's not like when you doubled processor chips, okay? When you go from 2 to 4 qubits, you're going from a little to an almost unbelievably huge amount of processing power. So I'm just going to read these three stars that show up on the end of this line. Around 2013, we reached the point where quantum computers our competitive performance with classical computers. And this is just a little bit to the right of where we are now with the 512Q Vesuvius 4. Okay, so basically quantum computers that can do anything a classical computer can do. Just a little bit north of there on the line, because again, we're going in a logarithmic function, around the year 2014, faster than all computers. And then just a little bit north of there and to the right, and well before the year 2018, I'm going to say before the year 2017 even, well within our 5-year period of time, faster than the universe. So you'll have one quantum computer that has more computing power than the entire universe has. And to me, okay, that's great because it just blows your mind to say it. And it's like, well, how can it be in the universe and it has more computing power than the universe? And of course, it's because actually a quantum computer isn't just in the universe. It's reaching out to all these other parallel universes. That's what's that's what's making it possible to do those calculations. But Stephen, one of the things we've been talking about, we keep coming back to the simulation hypothesis over the last month or so. It seems like that's a subject we've kept coming to. And one of the questions always is, well, how could you ever within this universe produce a simulation that's as rich as this universe? It would always have to be degraded. It would always have to be much grainier and much lower level quality, much lower resolution. Well, actually, if you can have a computer that can do more processing than the universe itself can do, potentially, theoretically, doesn't that solve that problem?
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, in a mind-blowing moment a couple of weeks ago, I was thinking to myself, how can we not, you know, not rule out the possibility that we're presently in a simulation on our way to, you know, at a substantial fraction of light speed to the nearest star, you know.
Right.
we're just passing the time and we don't even know it, to get, you know, to move through the universe slowly.
That's funny because I was watching The Matrix last night with my kids. They had never seen it, so this is very amusing.
There you go.
I just exactly. had a simulation hypothesis conversation at dinner tonight.
It comes
well,
up.
That's the other thing that's happened over the last 5 years. People talk about the simulation hypothesis a lot more than they used to. It's become a lot more popular. But I thought that was really cool. That's one of those things where if I saw it a couple years ago, I would have thought they were kidding. But I look at it now and I go, no, they seriously mean this. That we'll have a computer that has more processing power than the whole universe in the next 4 or 5 years, something like that. And that's enough to go on. We're going to see big stuff happen in the next 5 years.
No, it's an exponential within the exponential, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
It's you're putting an exponential number of qubits into these things every year. That's growing exponentially. But the power, when you put in an exponential number of qubits, is also exponential. So that's why it's curving up and out of sight faster than we can keep up with it.
Exactly. Okay, so with that, I'm going to move us. We're pushing well into our time here, and we still want to come back and talk a little bit about fast forward radio. This is our fifth anniversary. So let's talk a little bit about the other things that have happened over the past 5 years. And I thought it'd be fun to talk about what are the big moments, what are the outstanding moments, or just favorite things that have happened on the show that you recall that you'd like to share. Stephen, do you have one?
You know, we used to do a split that I really enjoyed back when we did it, and we should do it more often, and that's Tales of the Paranormal.
Yes.
You know, the roots of the show were just a little bit from what's the middle of the night program? Oh, my gosh.
Coast to Coast.
Coast to Coast. I'm driving out to the Rocky Mountain Blogger Conference in the middle of the night, listening for the first time. I never heard the program before. It's apparently been on for years and years. But in the middle of the night, listening to this program, and it was just sort of, you know, all paranormal all the time. It's big,
right.
UFOs, all, you know, everything. And it was very entertaining. And, particularly when you're driving through the middle of a desert, I find something about that just meshes well.
At 3 a.m., anyway, that's a good time to be reading about, or listening to people talk about UFOs or men in
exactly.
black or any of that
just
stuff.
Chupacabra, it's the whole deal. You can just imagine it just over the next, around the next corner. I got to thinking to myself, you know, the stuff that we're writing on Speculous would work well with this program, you know, with this sort of format. It would be just as mind blowing and fun, except for, you know, we're trying to base this on reality the best we can. And so that was sort of the idea behind, you know, Fast Forward Radio. But we would sort of go back to our roots just a little bit every now and then and do Tales of the Paranormal, which is always fun. And that's something where we ought to think about reviving every now and then.
Well, you know why I think we stopped doing it? Well, I love doing it. To me, that is one of the most fun things. To bring out a good Bigfoot story or something like that is just great fun. But I got thinking about this. Why did we stop doing Tales of the Paranormal? I think it might be because of the influence of Jim Elvidge, who we just had back on a month or so ago. And who has his own take on the simulation hypothesis, and who makes a compelling, if not 100% persuasive argument that maybe, and he's not saying he believes this, but this is just an interesting way of looking at it, that maybe all the paranormal stuff that occurs are actually Easter eggs in the Matrix, that we're living in a simulation, and these are little hints that we're living in a simulation, these odd things that occur. And once you look at it that way, once paranormal phenomena gets kind of integrated into the rest of the Speculous stuff, I don't know, it's not as target-rich an environment, I suppose, after that.
I would say, in the alternative, that maybe another reason we stopped doing it is because, you know, all the other stuff is so compelling and fun. You know, it's reality. When reality is this interesting, it's hard to pause and have fun with with fantasy, but it's we always seem to have fun when we did it. And whenever a good paranormal story comes up, I'm gonna throw it out as one we should revive that segment. And I hope you'll do the same.
All right. We'll see about bringing it back. Well, I don't suppose you have access. You couldn't play the old intro, could you?
I'll look and see. Give me an idea of what you're thinking about with past Fast Forward Radio.
Well, I'm going to have to go with the obvious. I think that our biggest moment has been those two special series we did, The World Transformed,
right,
where we brought in 30 brilliant people, futurists, artists, scholars, scientists, people from all different ways of looking at these issues, and talked through the major issues related to accelerating change, the major issues related to where the future is going, talking about the technological singularity, talking about artificial intelligence, nanotechnology, the end of scarcity, all these issues that we talk about in the kind of depth that we would like to get into every night, but it's impossible to get into every week. But every couple of years, you take a few weeks and really have those kinds of conversations. And I'll even crystallize a little bit there. I'll even hone in a little bit on that. I think especially, although they were all awesomes, the shows we did with Ben Goertzel and with Kevin Kelly last time around, The World Transformed 2, I think some of the best stuff we ever did, some of the best discussions that we ever had on the show. Ben Goertzel obviously has always just been an absolute joy to have on the show, his perspectives and the things he has to share, as have so many guests, names I could just rattle off names of people who have been incredible and awesome. But I guess if I was going to point to any two shows, it would be those two interviews that we did. I think those were among the best things we've ever done on the show. And I go back and listen to Kevin Kelly periodically. I just think he's such a fascinating guy.
Absolutely. Well, I found Tales of the Paranormal.
Oh, let's hear it. Yeah, we got to bring that back.
I just always love that.
we've got to bring that back. That announcer, he sounds just like the robot from Lost in Space, don't you think?
A little bit.
Yeah. How about you, PJ? Any particular memories from the past 5 years?
Well, I mean, for me, my first show with you guys, that was a real change for me. I had never done a podcast before.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
And you were such nice guys. Not that you aren't still now.
Yeah, well, we were being extra polite then.
It was such a pleasure.
We're on our best behavior.
I was really nervous to talk about all this empathy stuff. And it was an absolute delight. So that would probably be my favorite moment.
Absolutely.
Well, it's way up there near the top of the list for me too. It's always been great having you on. You're obviously you're the person we picked to be on our fifth anniversary show. I think that just says it all right there. So that's
absolutely
that's just, and there was that time, the only time that Stephen and I have ever sung together in public was that time we tried to sing Happy Birthday to you on the show.
Yes, bless your hearts.
It didn't work out. It just did not work out. It was in the round. And it was
I think we're going with the there's some weird delay thing, and that's why it didn't work, right?
Sounds good to me.
It was awful. It was absolutely awful.
That was
awful.
Our technical glitch that evening, I believe, is our... Yeah, but we've since retired, and we'll never sing Happy Birthday to anyone again. PJ
I'm doubly honored.
the one and only one we've ever done. I'd also highlight the shows we've done with John Smart have been particularly fun. He's always great to have on. And Stephen, I'll just throw this one out there.
Yeah.
All the grab bag shows we've done.
That's fun stuff.
Real life catches up with us, and suddenly it's Wednesday, and Stephen and I are shooting emails back and forth. Do you have anything to talk about? I mean, it's not like that, you know. It's like, hey, of all the brilliant things we could talk about, has anything risen to the top? And sometimes nothing has, and so we just say, well, we're gonna put together a few key ideas. And the interesting thing is that becomes this very organic thing that happens. We'll give it a theme, and we start talking about it, and these disparate ideas always seem to come together in unexpected and very interesting ways.
It gels into some sort of strange gumbo that seems to work out. It's awesome. Phil,
that's
your
Louisiana influence right there.
Yeah, that's not a Louisiana-ism. I'll throw that in there as my little lanyap I'm adding this evening. Anyway, I would also want to mention Michael Sargent, and we just had a wonderful time every time he was on the program with us. He co-hosted with several times when you couldn't be with us, Phil. It was he and I on the program together, and always just a very neat guy. And his loss a few years back is it's tough, but always great, always good to have him on the show.
He was a terrific guy, a real co-founder of The Speculist with us, one of the early bloggers of The Speculist and a participant on this program. And yeah, it was a terrible loss. I guess about 3.5 years ago. It's amazing how fast that time has gone by. But yeah, speaking of people who have come and gone from the show, in addition to Michael, was Michael Darling, who was a regular participant on just about every week for the first, I guess, year and a half or so, and
right.
Then other priorities emerged, and he's not been able to be with us. But it's interesting, when I was doing those best of shows last July, when we took a few weeks off, the shows with him on them, for no reason that I can think of, were the ones that got all the listens. And I told him about that, and he was just like, "Well, yeah, of course, naturally."
Well, I'm gonna say this as if there's no chance he'll ever hear this, but I'm gonna say it anyway. I always felt as though he's just a little bit of a loose cannon, and I always felt a little bit nervous when he was on the program because, what the hell is he gonna say next? It was always just a little bit that way. But you know what? That made it a better program.
That
so
made
I,
it fun.
I,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a good mix because when you and I chat, Phil, and we're having a good time and everything, that's cool. But you throw that element in, and it was always seemed to make it even better. So I hate that we have not had him on the program in a while.
Yeah. Well. Michael, if you're listening, we would love to have you join us anytime you want to come on back. We'd love to have you on.
Yeah.
I think of one other moment that I feel I have to mention, and that's the time that we left Robert Zubrin on hold for like 10 minutes.
He was none too pleased.
He was not happy with us.
No, he was not. I really thought that, That what was great about that, I really, really thought that he was going to, basically, he was angry at the beginning, and you could tell he was just aggravated. Basically tell you off and then hang up. He kind of
stay on the show just long enough
to tell me off and hang up.
Yeah.
But I mean, y'all went on and had a great program. That was an awesome program.
It was a really good interview, but we never got to talk to him much about the case for Mars. So
yeah,
had he hung up on us, we probably could have done a show about the case for Mars right then. And been like, well, if Robert had stayed on, we would,
instead we talked about his ideas with Flex Fuel, I believe.
Flex Fuels, which he's still pushing. You still see him writing pieces about that from place to place, and I think his thinking on that is about to become a little more mainstream. I think people are gonna start picking up on that. But that was a talk about a glitch that was just painful right there in the early days. That was
that was not great. But it was completely not your fault, Phil. That was absolutely 100% a glitch of the system.
That was our glitch for that evening.
We left him on hold forever, it seemed like, and didn't know he was there.
Well, and then there was the show
this one out, Phil.
Oh, go ahead.
This is one that I think is pretty hilarious. We love Aubrey de Grey, but you remember the time that you kind of insulted him about his beard? I thought that was pretty awesome.
I did not. That is a complete mischaracterization. What I did was I gave Aubrey the opportunity to address the issue. All right. I certainly did not insult Aubrey de Grey about his beard ever.
I can almost quote it exactly. What you said was, well, it's having an unconventional sense, as you do, does that distract from your message ever?
Well, I did use the term crackpot vibe, but I put it in quotes, and I didn't say that. I didn't say that I said that he had that. I was giving him a chance to defend himself against others who might say that. Okay, that was the.
Okay, all right. Yeah,
that was the point.
Bill, you're my new hero.
Everybody in the world has wanted to ask that question. You're the only one who ever has, probably. You know, I could imagine them wanting to ask it even on 60 Minutes, but nobody had the guts. But you did, Phil. So, there you go.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll own that. That's that's a big moment for us. I had forgotten about that. One other was when Philip Van Netteveld was on the first time, and Blog Talk Radio just lost the show, right?
Oh, it was awful, yeah.
The guy gets up at like 3 in the morning to be on the show with us, and we had this great interview. You know, obviously in memory, it's like the best 60 minutes in history. But, I mean, it was a really good discussion we had, and they just lost the show, and it was gone. And we were so frustrated with them after that. But then he came back on a few weeks later, and we had another good show, and we've had him on since, and it's always great having him on. Well, we're almost out of time, so I think we have to quickly jump to what needs to happen over the next 5 years on Fast Forward Radio, Stephen? I'll let you start with that. What should we do next,
Phil? I think that we're going to find that we'll have our hands full just speaking up. We've noticed that keep up with what's going on takes more and more effort, it seems, as the years go by than when we just began with the program. It was quite possible, it seemed to me, when we first started this program, that, you know, once the program was fine, you know, we could pretty much cover it, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we always feel like we're constrained with an hour program every single week. We always are right up against the time. Our poor live audience never gets to hear the music. It's because we can't seem to shut up right until the hour's pretty much up. So I think that it's going to become that's just going to be more and more a part of what we do. It's just to read everything and to try to be up on everything. So I guess that doesn't nothing grand there. It's just. Except that, it's just a realization of accelerating technology and how varied and exciting our future is going to be.
Okay. PJ, what do you think? Thoughts, advice for us over the next 5 years, things you'd like to see us do or things we could be doing better?
You two need to do a show from outer space.
Ah,
that would
5 years.
Awesome.
Wow, that's ambitious.
I'd be like Howard Wolowitz. I'd be the guy up there that's getting picked up.
that's
being mean to me.
that tops Jab. By the way, I should give Jab credit, our chat room buddy Jab, who gave me the info on Rose's Law. He put that up on my Facebook. That's how I had that. His idea was we should do a show from a self-driven car. And I think that might be more likely than space. Although I love that idea, PJ. I think that's a fantastic idea. Well, I'm gonna throw out
a space elevator. I'm on board for the space elevator.
We'll definitely do it from the space elevator for sure. Two thoughts over the next 5 years. We might think about migrating it off Blog Talk Radio if there's another platform that is more conducive. And a lot of options have been introduced in the time since we started, so we'll always be looking at those. And once again, Sirius or XM, if you're listening, we could be had. Also, Stephen, I'm just gonna throw this out here and just ponder it, okay?
Right.
New intro music. Just a thought. Nothing wrong with what we got. I'm just saying maybe, 5 years is enough, and we can try something else.
I'll keep my ears open.
Okay. Well, you are the music guy. And speaking of that, what is our music this evening?
The music this evening is Back of My Hand by Id Guinness.
Id Guinness singing Back of My Hand. Well, thank you, Stephen, for 5 years of awesome music and for 5 years of having a great time talking on Fast Forward Radio.
Awesome. Yeah, it's been great. Had a lot of fun.
PJ, thank you so much for being with us. We'll look forward to talking to you about your book in Q1 of 2013, and we look forward to having you back here sometime before then, too, okay?
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, guys.
All right. Take care. Well, everyone, we'll be back again at the regular time next week with a regular duration show, and we'll be back for the next 5 years tracking with you what's going to be happening next. So hope you'll all be with us. And until next time, live to see it.
Gone since 05 and feet out still alive.